Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name's John Nievenhuizen, and I'm chairing this last session. As you know, the University of Melbourne ranks number one in the competition in Australian universities, and I think that's maybe been in the minds of the people who've organised this session, because each of our speakers has an association with the University of Melbourne, beginning with Michael Keating, who has an honours degree in economics from there, and who spent a little time from Canberra as a resident fellow at Melbourne. And then when he became head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, everybody in the common room, of course, said, "Oh yes, I know Michael Keating." And John Altman also has got an association with the University of Melbourne. He was there as a senior tutor in the late 1970s and wrote his first joint book from there. And indeed, when he was interviewed, we only interviewed him on the phone, and he was so impressive just on the phone that he gained the appointment without us actually having seen him prior to his arrival. And then, of course, there's Sue Richardson, who's also an honours economics graduate from Melbourne University, and whom I've always regarded as rather a formidable person, seeing that in the students versus staff cricket match, she bowled to me. In the first delivery, I was out, caught and bowled. So thank you very much, everybody, for agreeing to start off the session. Each speaker has 5 minutes, and John is going to talk about quality and Indigenous people in Australia. Sue is going to speak more generally, and Mike is going to talk about government and equity in Australia, among other things. So, John, could you start off, and then Sue, and then Mike?
Thank you very much, John. And Peter, I don't mind being up here as an economist, though if you'd said ecological economist, I might have felt more comfortable, because I'm going to their conference tomorrow. I'm fortunate, at least theoretically, and having a foot in two camps. One is universalist and positivist as an economist, and the other one is social constructivist and cultural relativist as an anthropologist. And I think that having a foot in both those camps is really important. Now, I've had a slide put up from my presentation tomorrow, and I can't see it, but I can tell you what's behind there. What it shows is that a third of the Australian continent is now under land rights or native title ownership of some sort, exclusive or non-exclusive. And what it also shows you is 1,200 what are called discrete Indigenous communities that have a total population of only 100,000 people. So these are tiny places. And I guess I put that map up with the population because I really wanted to highlight what I see as the most intractable problem of inequality that we have in this country, which is remote living Aboriginal Australians. Now, the current response to that, and here I allude to some of the things that Brian Head was saying, is to appoint Andrew Forrest, a well-known member of the elite, to chair a review of Indigenous employment for the Prime Minister. And Andrew Forrest is a man who promised to create through the Australian Employment Covenant 50,000 jobs in the private sector for Indigenous people in 2 years. But that, of course, that target was never reached. But nevertheless, we have a proposal to adopt the Forrest Plan more broadly to deal with this deeply intractable problem of remote underdevelopment and unemployment inequality. We did see an overhead that showed that since the national apology and the proposal to close the gap, in fact, social exclusion for Indigenous people has increased. And that data was from HILDA. And I guess I would like to assure you that if we actually look at these most difficult remote places, that rate of inequality has increased far more than that graph showed. So the solution proposed by government is to have more of the same mainstreaming, and this is being proposed not just by the non-Indigenous elite like Andrew Forrest and Tony Abbott, but it's also now being proposed, I assume, by the Black elite, which includes Marcia Langton, who's now joined Andrew Forrest in his review. So again, referring to Brian Head's comments, I think we have very little analysis in this country about the interests of elites and how they operate. And I think as social scientists, this is something we need to look at a lot more closely. In my work, what I try and do is present evidence-based research to government about what works and what doesn't. And sometimes using government statistics and looking at government programs, I show them that things work reasonably well, given structural limitations of remote Australia. And the response on ideological grounds is to abolish the very programs that are making the best headways. An example of that is the Community Development Employment Program that delivered local enterprise, local activity and community development, but didn't deliver so-called real jobs. When I pointed this out to government members like Mark Arbib and Jenny Macklin, what they said to me was that these ABS figures couldn't be believed. The labour force survey, they said, didn't measure Indigenous employment properly. And when I suggested that 50,000 jobs wouldn't be created in 2 years and 1-0 should be taken off that summer, we might have a chance, Jenny Macklin said to me, we couldn't possibly say that in public. And when I said to her that the Cape York trial that's cost $100 million is showing growing Aboriginal unemployment, growing disparity in incomes between local Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, as she said again, the statistics from the ABS, from the census, must be wrong. So I wonder, in a way, where we go with evidence-based advice to government. I think that as social scientists, we're in a terribly difficult situation in terms of these intractable problems. On one hand, our role is to be critical social theorists and social commentators, and that doesn't matter who's in power in Australian society. But on the other hand, I think that increasingly, to have any impact on constructive policy input, we really have to be terribly polite to politicians. And I think that this is putting social sciences in a terribly difficult situation. And what it's in fact doing also is cleaving divisions within the social sciences and the academy, because we, on one hand, are highly dependent on what I would refer to as neoliberal tropes of the state in terms of funding to universities and being instrumentalist and helping government. But on the other hand, we have our due diligence to global scholarship, which requires us to analyse government action and tell it as it is. So I guess overall, I was very pleased to see today so much emphasis on Indigenous issues in the areas of health, education. I've said something about employment, and maybe if we're thinking about inequality, we can think about issues of scales of justice in terms of Indigenous Australians and some of the issues that Nancy Fraser raises in her tripartite framing of this. We've heard a bit about redistribution. We haven't heard much about recognition, although I think that this map shows we're seeing more and more recognition of land rights. But finally, there's that issue that we dealt with in that last session of representation. How do 3% of the national population have any influence? And here I'm reminded of Judith Brett's book, Fair Share, that shows that some sections of Australian society that are very small have undue influence, but Indigenous Australians seem to have very little say in Canberra. So thank you.
I understood my brief to be to reflect some ideas that have emerged from today's presentation, so I couldn't say in advance what I was going to talk about because I didn't know. But we have had a rich and diverse and informative set of presentations. And I'm just going to say a few things about the thoughts that came to my mind as I was listening to these contributions. Not necessarily coherent order. The inequalities that we heard about were principally focused on income, including measures of social exclusion. And the social sciences, I think, does have a bit of a unfortunate tendency to look for ain't it awful, partly because there is a lot that's awful out there, and part of our job is to identify and articulate and make that very sharp and clear. But there are also some good things that happen. I think this propensity to ain't it awful is one of the reasons why we perhaps don't have as much influence amongst policymakers as we would like to have. But there are some good things that have been happening on the equality front. In social equality, there was a mention of the greater resistance to discrimination on a whole variety of personal quality grounds. We are doing better in the labour market on gender equality than we ever have, and there's been really some extraordinary progress of women into the world of work that wasn't recognised. I think we're probably doing better on education in some ways, although there are some disturbing issues that were identified about the low end, but educational opportunity is much more widespread than it was a generation or two ago. Our life expectancy, of course, is going up for many people, and that's a summary measure of our general health. So there are some places where we're doing well. The income story, I think, is disturbing, and what the information was presented with a particular focus on the top 1%. Now, I know that that's a very graphic way of presenting inequality, measures of inequality of income, and it's also important to present it that way because there really is this extraordinary concentration of income and wealth at the very, very top, which you don't pick up in the broader measures of income inequality, and it's very appropriate to shine a bright torch on what's going on. I would have loved to have heard some more, and we may mull in the discussion to follow, about whether there's a real qualitative shift going on here. We've always had elites. All societies have elites. The elites, one of the reasons for being elite in the power structure historically has been because it enables you to garner your resources for yourself and your family. So that there's nothing new about that. The question is, has something dangerous happened here? Are the new elites, the really rich in Australia and in like countries, now so dominating the commanding heights of our society and the access to power and to control of information flows that they've become dangerous in a way that hasn't been the case in the past for the ordinary population, for the rest of us, for the 99%? And I'd love to see that question discussed rather more. And have they become different in kind? Are the rich in Australia now not just us who are lucky and clever, or are they really a different class of beast that chooses and is able to completely disconnect themselves from the Australian community more broadly? So I think I'd love to see that question explored rather more. The second point I want to reflect on is inequality of what? We did talk about, there was conversation about inequality of health, inequality of income, inequality of access to opportunities to participate. Michael Walzer, who's a political philosopher, wrote a book called Complex Inequality, decades ago now, but I think it made a very profound point, and one that I would like to see us regularly engage with in our conversations on inequality. And that is that all societies have inequalities in many domains of life, the things that people value, and they include health and knowledge and power and income and fame and status, the things that people value in their lives, and actually affection and love and companionship as well. If you want to have a more egalitarian or equal society, you cannot get rid of those inequalities. What you can do is perhaps compress them a bit, but the really crucial thing is to ensure that there's a disconnect between the position a person has in inequality on one domain and the position that they have in the hierarchy on other domains, so that you don't have a single domain, in our case probably income or wealth, that then determines where you stand on all the other hierarchies, that then determines where you stand in terms of love and affection, determines where you stand in status, determines where you stand on health, determines where you stand on education, determines where you stand on opportunities for your children. It's establishing that disconnect between those different domains, or avoiding the existence of a dominant domain. And if there is a dominant domain, then working on compressing the inequality in that dominant domain. I still think that that's a very important egalitarian agenda, which I haven't seen pursued vigorously in this country. It's embedded implicitly in a number of things that we do. Medicare is a pretty successful policy to disconnect access to health from your personal income. And a high-quality public schooling system is a similar thing. And I think that one of the margins for good scholarship is to see whether those boundaries are becoming less robust, and whether income is beginning to dominate in areas where we don't want it to. In the end, I don't care if some people can buy an extremely expensive watch and I can't. That's a matter of complete indifference to me. That's, if you have more money, you can buy more stuff. But I do care whether my inability to buy a really expensive watch means that my kid can't go to a decent school. So that's a thought that I'd welcome further conversations on. I also very much welcome the contribution that was made by several speakers, including Fran Boehm and Brian Head, that was encouraging us to think beyond descriptions of inequality and the individual position and the individual pathologies that might lead them to be in the position that they're in, and instead to ask the question, what are the social and economic and cultural systems that are causing unequal opportunities to be there, into which people will have to slot in the end? Everybody has to find a position, and if the only ones available are very unequal, then you will end up with a very unequal society, regardless of what you do to the individual capacities of people through your education system or your exhortation to work hard. And I think, for example, of Bob Gregory's very, very interesting and important observation that one of the reasons why labour productivity has gone up in Australia is because the least productive members of the workforce, in particular blue-collar men, have been forced out. They're not in the workforce anymore, and that removal of them has increased average labour productivity. Is that a good thing? No. That's because There's a whole group of people people who wish to be employed who no longer have an opportunity to be employed. So keeping your eye on the systems and the opportunities available rather than on the individuals and what might be their personal limitations to create successful places in our hierarchies for themselves. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I must say I find it a real challenge to sum up.
I must find it a real challenge to try and sum up such a rich conversation of today. I was asked to focus on policy issues, but even that's difficult. The first one, I've got about three I'd like to pick up, but the first one really follows on from what Sue had to say about the 1%. Rich 1%. We had quite a focus on the rich 1% in the presentations this morning. I guess my perception of policy making in this country is that it's really not been concerned so much about the rich 1%, but rather about the bottom 20% or bottom 10%. And that in that context, we've always thought we were pretty successful in terms of government intervention, in terms of trying to remove some of that disparity faced by the people in the bottom 20%. But the standard really was that we would compare them. We focused on relative poverty, not absolute poverty, and we always thought that we were trying to compare them with what was the median standard of living for the bottom 20%. We didn't really aspire, I think, as in government or government advisors, to what they would need in order to live like Gina Rinehart. But really, you know, what were they missing out on that ordinary people got? And in that context, I think, you know, we have been reasonably successful in the past. Peter Whiteford's the expert on this as far as I'm concerned, but his work shows that we achieved the second amount of redistribution of that bottom 10-20% to any country other than Denmark, but we do it for 1/8 of the cost. So we're incredibly effective. I think there's a question about how far we can continue to be so effective, and that might raise the question of increasing taxes at the top, because so far I can't remember, and I'm getting pretty old, I can't remember a government campaigning, going to an election campaigning for an increase in tax. And indeed, the most recently elected government has been getting rid of taxes, including measures that would stop the hemorrhaging of the existing tax system. So it is a question about whether we need to face up to arguing, if we're concerned about equality, arguing for an increase in tax just to finance the sort of system that we think we want. The second issue I want to pick up is a dimension of inequality that I don't think was explored today, and that surprised me a little bit. And that's what I'd call geographic stratification. Now, if I go back to 1970 or even more recently, it didn't matter which postcode you lived in Australia in terms of your employment participation. The employment participation rate was the same in just about every postcode in Australia, was close to the same. By the end of the 1990s, that was no longer true. In fact, in some postcodes, the participation rate's about half what it is in the norm. To me, that has enormous consequences for our society, because obviously when you're talking about opportunities to participate, it's influenced by the family that you're raised in. But it's also influenced by the community you live in, by the school you go to, and so on. And really what we're facing now with that complete change in employment participation, I suggest, is a much greater degree of social stratification by geography than the world that I grew up in, and so on. And I think that's hugely important. Probably has also consequences for mobility, because, and I haven't seen data on this, but one of the arguments the Americans always gave, okay, they were very unequal, but there was a big, there was a lot of opportunity. It was a very mobile society as compared with Europe. So it may have a more equal income distribution at any point of time, but there were lots of young people who wouldn't stay there. But if I'm right that we now have geographic stratification like we never had before, then I wonder whether we have the same mobility that we used to have. I suspect we haven't. The third point I want to raise is participation in education. You may recall that Andrew Leigh gave that as one of his most important policy changes. The first one was economic growth, and the third one was changing the sort of social mood in Australia, I guess, in support of equality. But I want to focus a little bit on participation and education. Now, when we look at the data, we find that the participation is very different according to your level of education. In particular, those who don't complete year 12 at school and have no further education have very much lower rates of participation. And in addition to that, the big fallout of male blue-collar workers that Sue mentioned only a mile ago, that's almost entirely confined to people who left school and who have no further qualification. That is very suggestive that qualifications are essential to achieving high levels of participation. And I would continue, I think today's sobered me up a bit, that employment participation isn't everything when it comes to social participation. But it's still very important. So qualifications are important. The question is, though, our schools, given the geographic disparities that I've just been referred to, the ability of people to send their children to private schools, so they're flocking more and more to schools of excellence, particularly the middle class, so fewer role models are in ordinary schools of excellent academic kids and so on. But we're still funding schools on a very even basis. And I suppose, I think a real question is whether the funding mechanism needs to change, and change by a lot more in terms of redistribution, in terms of disadvantaged schools, or perhaps rather more in terms of disadvantaged pupils, a lot more than was suggested by Gonski. I mean, after all, Gonski is splashing a hell of a lot of money at a problem where the terms of reference said that no school should lose, not even the richest school should lose a cent. And then the then Prime Minister, when she got the report, she decided that every school had to win. Now, I really query if we're fair dinkum about redistribution, whether we can have a world where no one loses. I think we need to restructure the debate so that some school funding gets redistributed, so that some people may pay more taxes. Now, final observation on participation in education is one thing I learnt today is that the problem is a lot more difficult than I'd previously thought, particularly the presentations by Jan Scuttlebowl and by Brian Head really brought out the difficulties in engaging disadvantaged students. Now, we've tended to take the view very often if we put the offering before them, then that's sufficient. But ensuring, we need to ask ourselves not only what do they need, but why didn't they get it first time round? Why did someone leave at 15 and never go back? And that's that sort of question we need to build in. A couple of issues I think that need to be on the future agenda, and I raised one in a comment earlier today to Brian, is the roles of government in that world where you're going to perhaps a much more decentralised system of delivery, which is much more focused on individuals or individual communities. What is the role of the government, which is still going to fund it, and how is it held accountable? And the second issue, which I think is particularly appropriate for the academy, is the role of evidence. I mean, it rolls off the tongue very easily. We ought to have evidence-based policy. But if you're moving to a very nuanced solution where there's no one size fits all, where you're dealing with complexity. I mean, Brian Head put it that there's no solution in the traditional sense. Really, you think more in terms of a process to be followed. Now, if that's the nature of the policy problem in the future, what type of evidence are we looking for? Thanks.
Well, we have some time for contributions from the floor, and I invite you. I've got two. There's one, two, three, four hands that I can see, five. So we start down here with Jeff and then Keith, and here's another one here. And I invite you to make a comment and or ask a question.
Jeff. I think I've jumped to the top.
It's all right. You're there, Jeff. Yes. You're very welcome.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say how incisive I thought our three summers up were. Very important questions, made very important contributions. But I want to put a even bigger background to it, and that's, I think we've got to look at our place in a world economy, And I want to start off with a quote from the late Paul Samuelson, who in his ninth decade, which I've now reached myself, sober thought, except that he got to his 10th decade, he was comparing Europe and the USA. And he said, no economist, as far as I know, remarks like that, has noticed that compared to Europe, America is now characterized by a ruthless capitalist class and a quiescent and cowed workforce. And I quoted that when I wrote an essay on his views on Marx by saying, if only Karl could have lived to see this hour. Because what we've witnessed in the world, I think, from the 70s on, is the rise of multinational oligopolies, which not only dominate governments, they also dominate production and distribution and selling in the world as a whole. And one of their objects is to so change the internal distributions of income within each country that you have a potentially greater surplus available for accumulation. What they've forgotten about in many countries is that there is a basic contradiction that if you create sustained unemployment, which is a byproduct of monetarism and what followed from it, Tommy Balog called it the incomes policy of Karl Marx, you also damp the animal spirits of entrepreneurs. And so you get very disappointing, many places, accumulation rates. So one of the backgrounds to inequality is the rising unemployment concerned with the basic contradiction in the world economy, which has been added to by deregulation and much technical progress, which is terribly short-termism, which has allowed speculators to make a killing on financial markets, not encourage long-sighted entrepreneurs to go into industry.
By the way, I'm going to give an opportunity to members of the panel to respond at the end. We go to Keith now.
Yes, I want to take up an issue with Mike Keating. He talked about the association of leaving school before year 12 with being out of the workforce. And I thought slid very quickly into the presumption that this was cause and effect. I'm not certain that is so. I think it's very doubtful, in fact. We used to talk about the qualifications and credentialism. The qualifications you had determined who got the job, but it wasn't necessarily because you needed the qualifications to do the job. And I just wonder whether failure to complete year 12 is symptomatic of lack of talent, for example, which determines the proportion of our labour force that doesn't get work. I find it a very dismal inference to draw, but I'm not sure that it's a wrong one. And if of course my doubts are right, that would call into question flowing such a high proportion of limited government resources into improving educational opportunity. I'd be glad of Mike's response.
Margaret Thornton, ANU. I wanted to say something about the change in public discourse, the movement away from using words like inequality. Even just the word justice has become ineffable. And the shift that's occurred to the notion of freedom. So our new Attorney General, Senator Brandis, has announced that he's going to actually change. Change the rate.
Sorry, but, can everybody hear?
Oh, I'm sorry, is that not loud enough? That he's going to appoint freedom commissioners. So freedom of speech, at least one, he said, freedom of speech and possibly freedom of religion. And so he said that there is too much focus upon equality and discrimination. So I'm very concerned about this shift in the public discourse, and because this particular line has in fact been done consistently in the Australian newspaper since the Etok and Bolt case, and that was the case in which Andrew Bolt made derogatory remarks about light-skinned Aboriginal people, and there was such outrage on the part of Senator Brandis and other conservative commentators that he has vowed to change the law, and that'll be one of the first things to do. So it seems to me, I mean, this ideological factor is almost insuperable, however much we talk about what might be done and line graphs and so on. Reality is, it seems to be extraordinary in the present climate.
Thank you. There are quite a few hands up there.
Yes, I wanted to comment on what John Altman says. He says that there has to be a future for the Aboriginal community in the land he showed on the map. Now, post-World War II, a whole lot of rural Australia was vacated by farmers because the land wasn't viable enough to make a living. And if you travel in inland New South Wales, Queensland, and so on, you'll see towns that have gone absolutely broke, and you'll see farms that are not working. Now, a huge percentage of Australia is non-arable land. That land that he showed us that most of the Aboriginal community live on would already have been taken by white Australians if it was viable land where you could make a living. So to, in my view, to pretend that Aboriginal people are going to be able to make a living off that land is very wishful thinking. We have to work out a different way to sort out inequality amongst Aboriginal community than thinking their future is going to be on those very remote areas where the white Australians couldn't even make a living, and that's what they were like in those times. Thank you.
There are some...
Yes, I've heard some wonderful presentations today, and they've been absolutely excellent. But there are a couple of points. I did think perhaps a bit more could have been said about the intersections with various forms of inequality. It's great we've had some good content on intersections of Indigenous inequality, but I do think a bit more could have been said about gender inequality, given ongoing differentials in wages and problems of the feminisation of poverty. And also a bit more could have been said about various forms of race and ethnicity. But actually, my main point is another one. I'd also have preferred a bit more to have been said perhaps about some of the future challenges Australia will face. And we've partly seen this with debates over the patchwork economy during the Gillard years and arguments about the impact of the resources boom on other sectors of the economy. But to go back to Jeff's point about us being in a period of globalisation, I mean, this does cause huge challenges and disjunctions to the Australian economy. And some of those disjunctions not only involve long-term problems of uneven development being exacerbated between different sectors with implications for employment, but also increasingly a situation where new information technology is seeing impacts on white-collar workers now of the sort that we have seen previously with globalisation on blue-collar workers, work from lawyers to people in design to people in accounting being contracted out at basic levels to workers in the Philippines or India or wherever. And a whole lot of the arguments about education are assuming that we'll be able to sell our services in the Asian century to the growing market of the middle class in Asia. but in fact we may be facing unexpected forms of competition, and we need to look a bit more at some of the arguments about education and the assumptions that are underlying them.
Thank you. I see Bob's got the mic there.
I think one of the real truisms for social sciences is that any variable that you want to look at, social or economic variable, is positively skewed. And when you add the dimension of territorial space, and as a geographer, that's what I do, it becomes even more apparent. Michael, you made the suggestion that where people live locally and the nature of local labour markets is important, and I couldn't agree more. But I guess one issue I would take up with you is that I've been studying spatial differentiation of social and economic phenomena for the best part of 50 years now. And I can assure you that back in the 60s and 70s, there was just as much, in statistical terms, spatial differentiation in socioeconomic patterns across Australia's cities and towns and rural areas as there is now. But the nature of that distribution and where there are concentrations of so-called problems in terms of the sorts of dimensions that Fran put up, the 30 or so of them this morning, they have changed in terms of where things are impacting. Back in the earlier part of the post-war period, it was the inner city areas that were very disadvantaged in income terms and other terms. They're certainly not now. It's largely the outer suburbs and some of the regional areas. But I think it's if we're looking in terms of positive outcomes and how we can address these differentials, whether it be across space or income groups or whatever, we need to very carefully measure where the concentrations are, what the magnitudes of them are, what the nature of the changes both in the long term and short term are, and then design the appropriate potential interventions that are oriented to particular people, places, or whatever.
Thank you. There are two up there and then the lady down here. Okay.
I wanted to, Jim Walter from Monash. I wanted to raise the issue of value dispositions that Brian pointed out in his talk. This morning, there was a question when we were talking about investment in Indigenous disadvantage or to address Indigenous. Why don't the policy class get it? I couldn't help reflecting on the front page of today's Financial Review, where there's an article about Maurice Newman, appointed by Abbott to chair some sort of business advisory council, who said more or less that Gonski and the National Disability Scheme were lunacy, we couldn't afford them in the current climate, and so on. That, of course, is a very powerful value disposition. If one of us stood up and said, we can't afford not to invest in addressing these areas of disadvantage, we wouldn't have got a story on the front page of the Fin Review. The thing that struck me lately, talking to governments and talking to policymakers in government, is that you get extraordinary changes. One of the things we have to address as a social scientist is these sort of changes in policy-relevant belief systems. The Victorian government and the Queensland government, with whom I've been having some dealings to do with water management and water catchment, with the change of government, completely changed their policy approaches and indeed in many cases got rid of the public servants who'd led the quite successful measures of previous years. So it's back to this question of evidence-based policy.
these sorts of core beliefs and ideologically relevant beliefs will determine what evidence particularly politicians, will accept. And we're seeing this with changes of government. As social scientists, we need to think very hard about how to address this and how we speak, how we can speak across those gaps when we confront them in the policy domain.
Thank you. I've got one there, and then there are two anxious. All right, let's take the lady here first. Thank you.
Thank you. So three things, and I say these things as a young Australian who I have very, 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 very much hope for the future of Australia, politically and all otherwise. One, I think we need academics who are not afraid to be political. And so my hat off to you, John Altman, because, yeah, I think that's what I know that we need, academics that are not afraid to be political and who have not taken the wrong lesson from something like the history wars or something like that. Because Australians need to be empowered to think in terms of justice and human rights. And this will mean that eventually we do get a government that is prepared to privilege the value of political equality over and above the value of economic growth or over and above the value of market ideology. Yes, that's it.
Yeah, I'd really like to echo that last remark. Frank Stillwell from University of Sydney, a relatively low-ranked institution. It all depends on your benchmark, of course. Carol referred to matters that could have been given more emphasis in the program, and I think she's right, but I do compliment Susan, Peter and Sheila on producing a very good program with excellent speakers. Perhaps, from my point of view, the one thing that we haven't really focused on, though, is the role of sustainability and environmental and climate change concerns, because you might say that's a bit outside the central brief here, but there's a very strong connection. If we have an increasingly unequal society, I think the prospects for grappling with these ecological and environmental issues is so much more problematic. There has to be some presumption that we have a common situation, an equality of sacrifice, a capacity to work as a community to make the necessary policy changes. And an increasingly unequal society, that seems to be a much more remote prospect. And I see with the election of the current Australian government, the first indications of the challenges that lie ahead in that oh so important field.
Thank you. I do want to give a chance to the panel to respond. Is there one pressing question or comment down here? Thank you.
Fran Bauman, sorry, no links to the University of Melbourne. Just wanted to really comment on something Sue said and something Jeff said. I mean, I think we focused on the 1% because we have data on that, but I agree with you. I think the big issue is transnational corporations, and the public health community is increasingly turning its research attention. We're doing that at the Southgate Institute at Flinders. And looking systematically, we're currently writing something to look systematically at the practices of those corporations that are health damaging. And the more our literature review continues, the more scary it is. I mean, that goes from the way that they influence the IMF, the World Bank, TRIPS agreement, GATS agreement to make the world safe for rampant capitalism, down to the marketing of unhealthy foods, tobacco, soda, and so on. So, you know, I think, yeah, the 1% benefit from that, but I think the real game as a fundamental social determinant are the power and reach, both the political power and economic power of those corporations.
Thank you for all those interesting comments. Did you, John, wish to start by any responses?
I'd like to make a couple of responses. To Jeff and Frank, I think that the issue of neoliberal globalisation is of fundamental importance to understanding what we're talking about, and it does amaze me that the word neoliberal didn't occur, we didn't hear it once today in terms of troop or in terms of ways of thinking. I think the question in terms of inequality in relation to Australia that we should be asking is, why isn't Australia more unequal? And the answer is because we are major commodity exporters and we are highly commodity export dependent. 60% of our commodity exports are minerals and oil and gas. And if we were a developing country, the United Nations would probably give us a very low credit rating. So I think we need to keep that in mind. And also in relation to what's going on in terms of the United States, the ruthless capital class and the acquiescent cowed workforce, there is one element of US society that's not cowed, but most of them are in prison. And the imprisonment rate in the United States is 2,200 per 100,000, the highest in the world by a long way. And Indigenous Australian incarceration rates are pretty similar, and they're 15 times the non-Indigenous rate. So I think it's worth thinking about. I need to make a response in relation to Indigenous remote living. I'm very inspired in my readings by the writings of John Holmes on multifunctional transitions. John's sitting right next to you. But more seriously, I think that values of Indigenous lands have changed fundamentally, not just in terms of potentiality, in terms of carbon farming possibilities and biodiversity conservation possibilities and Australia's international obligations in terms of the CBD, the Convention for Biological Diversity, but also some of those transitions that we're seeing in remote Australia are opening up opportunities in consumption industries and in conservation industries that I think weren't available to farmers in the period that you're talking about. So I think we're living in a very different world. I'm not advocating, though, that Indigenous people who choose to live on their ancestral country in remote Australia will be able to live at the standard of living of people who live on Sydney Harbour. And I think that it's incumbent on policymakers and all of us to make it quite clear that if you choose to live out here, you won't have equality. The question that I raise is that agenda of equality driven by Canberra, or is it driven by people living in outstations in Arnhem Land?
Thank you, sir.
I would like to take up the proposition that the concentration of inequality, of wealth and power very much at the top, is dangerous. The power of the multinational corporations that Fran was referring to, and the broad proposition that Jeff Harcourt was also making, that capital wishes to have an acquiescent workforce while it's rather tough pursuit of its own interest is thus unimpeded. And I think that as a threat to the future well-being of Australia, that is something that we need to take seriously. Partly because of the nice phrase that Sean Wilson used, the hardening of the interest in inequality, because they're the beneficiaries. So, of course, they're the one group that will not be struggling against inequality, but also because of the capacity to distance themselves for the consequences of inequality and the consequences of degradation of the environment. Who cares if you just fly to wherever there is a remaining beautiful spot in the world that you can actually buy a house at or whatever, ready access to? So I do think that this is an issue of the global elites that we have to, really be, as scholars, produce evidence on, and as citizens, be deeply concerned about and be brave enough to speak up about. The second question comment does arise from a point raised, I can't remember by who, about what, in effect, are we going through this? Are we going through a disruptive period in our economy that might have parallels even as profound as the Industrial Revolution, with the technological change that's going on. The technological change that's unquestionably favouring people with skills over people without skills, but probably much more significantly is enabling the world economy to be an integrated place. And for a country like Australia that's already very well placed, that is likely to be harmful to those of our citizens, of which there are likely to be many, who cannot actively and skillfully take advantage of the opportunities that provides, because they're now competing with 7 billion other people. For the world as a whole, it's likely to be to reduce inequality. So if we take a global perspective, this may be a good thing. The question is, from an Australian perspective, how do we manage that? How do we get through that in a way that doesn't have impose on the current generation the harms that the people who lived through the Industrial Revolution had to endure in order to sustain the standard of living that we have today?
Yep. First of all, Jeff Harcourt's comments. I can't pick up The Australian without reading every time someone talks about redistribution that it's wealth envy or something.
It's class war.
Class war, that's right, class war.
Only comes from one side.
Yeah, yeah. That's right, it's class war. So it's, what you said has got to resonate. I guess the only thing I would add is that, you know, I think it's too early to tell whether this is a continuing threat over a longer period, because it's not that long since the Keating government fell, and Keating was never taken in by that sort of bullshit. I mean, he did a hell of a lot of redistribution. He wasn't worried about that. I mean, he didn't tackle the problem of increasing taxation, but he certainly shore up the revenue and did things like capital gains tax, et cetera, fringe benefits and so on. So I think it's too early to tell. And then we see other countries with broadly similar economic systems which do manage to, you know, sustain equality and so on. Now, how can they do that in a globalised world if the critics are right? So I think you're right to point to the danger, but I don't think it's something that we have to take, that there isn't a good answer to, if I can put it that way. And finally, in my view, most of the wealthiest people in Australia are rent seekers. that's how they make their money. They've created very little. They've got the hand. They've manipulated government regulation, typically. Keith Hancock. Look, I as said, I graduated from Melbourne University as a student of Jean Polglase, so I was taught that you can't, a statistical correlation doesn't show cause and effect. I guess while I can't prove it, I think there's quite a bit of persuasive evidence that a lack of qualifications by early school leavers is right at the centre of their problem of getting a job in today's world. You mentioned a lack of talent. I mean, I imagine talent's something you're born with, and I can't see why the current generation of people are born with less talent than earlier generations. But what I do note is that the nature of jobs has changed. An unskilled job once on a pick and shovel where you put earphones on in a steel mill or whatever is different to the sort of job in a steel mill today. And you really can't do that sort of job without, you know, some basic numeric skills, literacy, reading, just to pass the occupation. A lot of our workers, of course, today wouldn't pass the basic occupation health and safety standards if they were put to the test. And finally, where we've taken very long-term unemployed people, particularly in Adelaide, actually, which is where I've been working, where we've taken them and we've given them the sort of case management services and so on that go with the skilling, we've got phenomenal results. I mean, we're getting much better retention rates and completion rates of skills than TAFE gets normally. than the average for TAFE, with the, you know, the most difficult possible people. But it is expensive. But I would argue it's even more expensive to do nothing. Impact of globalisation. I'm probably going to differ from some of you on this. I think, well, obviously, some white-collar jobs have gone off overseas. We are also, we're exporting, white-collar services. I mean, Andrew Lee gave the example this morning when he joined the law firm. The stars worked for in New South Wales. Now they work in Asia Pacific. And it's just, like the ABS data just show, a massive growth in white-collar services, including education and health. If you look at where the jobs are being created in Australia, it's in the professions. We've had phenomenal growth in the professions. Incidentally, we also had very fast growth in unskilled jobs of a service kind. As Andrew Lee put it again, you still get your hair cut by someone who's in Australia, probably not too far away too. So it's the hollowing out in the middle that I think has been affected, not so much by globalisation as by technology. I think that's a big story, but I think that's where the evidence is. On the spatial differentiation of Australia, look, I agree, obviously different suburbs had different wealth and so on, different educational backgrounds and so on. That's always been true. In Melbourne, Toorak is always the richest suburb, and it still is, or close to it. But what is different since around 1990 is the employment participation. Okay, a bloke in Footscray, he mightn't do the same job as someone in Toorak, but he had a job. He was as likely to have a job whether he lived in Footscray or Toorak. That is not true today. That's the difference I'm pointing to. And, having large numbers of people growing up in unemployed families is a new and in unemployed communities. That's a different phenomenon. Finally, Frank Stillwell's point on sustainability and inequality. I'm outside my field now. I thought Sean's presentation earlier, the message I got from that was that the people who are, if you like, switching their votes away from the environment are the ones who feel insecure. And that's not hard to understand, actually. And equally, it's the professional middle class who think they've all got very secure jobs who are most in favour of doing something about the environment. They're the ones who join the Greens. So I guess if you're concerned about sustainability, we've got to reduce inequality and insecurity.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of what I hope you'll agree is a scintillating performance by our three panellists, and with a very good interchange with the audience, I'd ask you to join me, please, in thanking them. Sheila Shaver now wishes to say a wider thank you.
Won't keep us from the president's drinks more than just a minute. I just want to wind up the seminar, the symposium, first by thanking our speakers and the fine set of papers that we've had today. Many people have asked about what might become of this, and we are exploring what the options might be to bring these papers together in some published form. I'd like to thank all the participants in the discussion, John and this panel, but also all of you. It's been a lively day in the brief moments after each paper as well as now, and that makes it more a symposium and less a set of talks. Thanks to the ABS for their production. We had wanted this not to be a day of slides explaining inequality. They've enabled us to read that instead. And I want to thank the Academy, both the Academy and its committees, especially the Public Forums Committee, but also the ASSA Secretariat for all the work that goes on behind the scenes to make a day like today possible. possible. And particularly important there are Peter Spirit and Margaret Blood. Thank you, and drinks await us. One last tip, if you're coming back for the Cunningham lecture, it would be wise to leave something on your chair to save your seat, because the public will be coming in while we're off having a drink.